Fletcher 9, Heresy and the Millennium.
Welcome to Lecture 9 of the Terror of History. In Lecture 8, we concluded the discussions of mysticism by looking at the lives and actual mysticism of Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross. And now for something completely different. In this second segment, we are going to look at two intertwining topics. One is heresy, and the other one is the millenarian movements or apocalyptic movements. Please understand that not all millenarian movements, that is to say, not all heresies, are millenarian, though most millenarian movements are heretical. On the other hand, in the Christian tradition, the idea of the millennium is an orthodox one. So we have here a series of contradictions. Unlike mysticism, which is essentially a high culture phenomenon, we know about the mystics because they wrote, and they wrote in a very rarefied and erudite language about questions of the soul, abstract ideas. Heresy and the millennium combine both elements of the popular and of high culture. There are certain heresies that are indeed very, shall we say, complex and intellectual, and there are some heresies that are popular in nature. The millennium, on the other hand, is almost always popular in nature. What I want to do today is to look at the, shall we say, the broad context of heresies and of millenarian movements, the different types, the taxonomies of heresies and of millenarian movements. And in the next lectures, we will talk about specific heresies and specific millenarian movements. Let us begin with heresies. What is heresy? The definition is very simple, and I should not spend too much time dealing with this. Heresy is to hold beliefs which go against the dogma of your own religion. Meaning by this, that a Muslim or a Jew cannot be a Christian heretic and will never be under the jurisdiction of such institutions like the Inquisition. You can only be a heretic of your own religion when you have beliefs and when you espouse them, beliefs of such nature that they run counter to some of the basic dogmas of the religion. Let me give you an example. One of the basic dogmas of Catholicism is the idea of transubstantiation. Transubstantiation is the dogma, it's a dogma of the Church, which says that in the moment of the elevation of the host, the bread turns into the actual body of Christ, into the flesh of Christ, and the wine turns into the actual blood of Christ. This is not metaphorically done, this is not symbolic, this is the actual conversion of the bread into flesh, of the wine into blood. I know that many Catholics today don't think of this as they take communion. You don't think that you are engaging in an act of cannibalism. But that's precisely what you are doing. That is to say, that's precisely what is done. If you argue, as for example, the Protestant Reformation will argue, that transubstantiation does not occur, that this is only a symbolic recreation of the Last Supper, then you are going counter to one basic dogma of the Church, and you are therefore a heretic. I think I want to point out here one undeniable fact, that the evolution of dogma in the Christian Church is the result of the antagonisms between different points of views, that heresies are instrumental in the creation of orthodoxy. There is no orthodoxy without heresy, and there is, of course, no heresy without orthodoxy. And that at the end, it really comes out to a question if I may be vulgar historian about this, and if I may be blunt about this, at the end it comes out to a question of power. That is to say that heresies are defined by the victors. You have arguments and debates about certain points. I could give you an example of this. In the early fourth century, there is a debate about the nature of the Trinity within the Christian Church. This is a rather difficult and complex debate about the nature of the Trinity. Are all three persons of the Trinity one and the same, or is there an order of, in a sense, thus the Son follows from the Father but is not co-equal or co-eternal with the Father? One position was held by people whom we call Arians, the followers of a bishop in Alexandria called Arius, and the other position, which is the present one, the Trinitarian one, was essentially held by Athanasius, a canon in Constantinople. The emperor presides over the council that decides on these matters, the Council of Nicaea, and there the emperor sides with Athanasius. That becomes orthodoxy. The Arians, who hold the other kinds of views, are sent out into the wilderness and are branded heretical and are severed from the church. So in a sense, we could see how through time dogmas develop within the Christian church. But it occurs also in other religions as well. That is to say, that there is this conflict between differing opinions, and eventually one emerges victorious and drives the other one into heterodoxy. Heresy is part and parcel of the history of Christianity. There are heresies from the very beginnings of Christianity. There are periods like the 3rd and 4th century where there are many, many heresies. And then the late Middle Ages is a period of very active heretical movements. And we are going to look specifically at two of them. And the church is always defining what heresy is and so on. Now, I want to present here a taxonomy of heresies. What kind of heresies do we find? How many heretics? What type of heresies do we find historically? There are five kinds of heresies. One is the reformist. And I am thinking here with some historical specificity. In the 11th century, during the investiture controversy, there are people who are so committed to the idea of reform that they will go beyond what the church is willing to go to. So people who want to reform the church beyond what the church is willing to accept eventually will fall out of orthodoxy into heresy. And there are many examples of this in the 11th century, and of course there are many examples of this in later periods as well. For example, there is, as we speak, an incredible attempt to make the Virgin Mary, I read in the newspaper the other day, like 70 million signatures have been collected around the world to make the Virgin Mary a co-redeemer with Christ. Of course, eventually the Pope is speaking ex cathedra, and that is another dogma. When the Pope speaks from the chair, he is infallible. The Pope will make a determination on this. He will say no or yes. But there will be reformers who want this to go on, and if they don't give up on their ideas, they might be branded heretical. You have the people whom we call eccentrics, people who hold such out-of-the-way views that they are in complete lack of accord with orthodox positions. And those are mostly individuals, are not movements. Then you have the Catarist, which is one of the largest heresies in the history of Christianity. And I will talk about them in detail in the next lecture, in lecture 10. Then you have the reactionaries, people who do not want to accept the transformation of the church and the change in church views or in church liturgy or forms. I give you an example of this. For example, in the early 1960s, there was a huge reforming council called the Council, the Second Vatican Council. One of the things that they did was to change the language of the liturgy from Latin to the vernacular. please understand that until the 1960s, the language of the church was Latin. And people love to attend things that they do not understand because it provides a kind of mystery. So that there is a good number of people who in 1960s felt that it was a betrayal of the ideas of the church to go to the vernacular, and who insisted in still attending or indeed having masses in Latin perform. The church sort of looked the other way and allow some of these people to have masses in Latin from time to time. But when they insisted that the only language of the liturgy is Latin, then they fall into the heretical fault. And in fact, one of the bishops in southern France was thrown out of the church, which of course leads us to a very important and realistic issue here. That is to say, you cannot brand someone a heretic unless you have the power to enforce the penalties for being a heretic. That is to say, if you live in the modern world and you do not believe in many of the dogmas of the church, no one, supposedly, at least in most countries, is going to come out and get you and put you in prison or burn you at the stake for holding views that are not in accord with the orthodox ideas. And then the final category, the fifth category for us, is that of the intellectuals, people who hold and who break with established religion on intellectual grounds, who break from the religions on highly cerebral intellectual notions. A very good example of this, of course, is Baruch Spinoza, the greatest mind of the 17th century, who is expelled from his synagogue in Amsterdam because of the pantheistic views he holds, which are based upon intellectual reflection. So much for heresy. In next lecture, we are going to go back to heretics, and we are going to look at three important heretical movements, one of them both a heresy and millenarian at the same time. And now we turn to the question of the millennium. And I want to point out to you how alive the millennium is with us. Just a few years ago, a group of people, all well-educated, all rather middling sorts, middle class, in San Diego, in California, where the sun shines most of the year, where it never really rains, gathered together in a community known as Heaven's Gate, and they believe that there was a comet coming across, and behind this comet was this spaceship which was going to gather them into a higher level of consciousness. Not only did they all commit suicide so that they can lead themselves into a higher form of consciousness, but they also even castrated themselves as a way of removing themselves from the temptations of the world. This did not happen in the Middle Ages. This did not happen in the early modern period. This happened today. We have examples of this millenarian attitude all the time. This country, of all countries in the world, the most advanced technological country in the world, the leading democracy in the world, is crawling with millenarian expectations. Is present in the language of presidents, so that President Reagan could speak about Armageddon and the final battle against the forces of evil, the evil empire. Is present among religious sects. When I went to teach at Baylor to give a lecture there, one of the things that people wanted to show me was the site where that sect, the Dravinian sect, was there expecting also the millennium. History is filled with this sense of apocalypsis. What are the origins of that? The origins of the apocalypse is, of course, to be found in the very distant past. It's to be found in that cradle of all the ideas of the West. In the place that we call today Iran, which was called Persia in antiquity, but which had other name 1500 years before the Common Era. It is the world of the great heroes of Gilgamesh. It is a world that dates back 3,000 and 4,000 years before the Common Era. It is the beginnings of humanity. And in this place, which we call Iran, we have the development of very specific views and ideas about time and the future. In an earlier version of this world, in these very early manifestations, cultural manifestations of this world, which is the Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the absolutely founding texts in the history of the West. In fact, you could read the book of Genesis, and there are entire sections of the book of Genesis that are taken verbatim from the Epic of Gilgamesh. So in the Epic of Gilgamesh, there are great heroes who keep the terror at bay. The terror at bay because the view of time was cyclical. Time repeated. The world repeated itself continuously. We are in a cycle. And that cycle leads us to some kind of total obliteration. And then we begin again. And it is these great heroes, the Gilgamesh and Enkidu and others, who keep the terror at bay. But then something else comes in. The ideas of Zoroaster and others. And the idea that the world is divided between two conflicting notions of good and evil. I want to point out here, as I will point out later when I discuss the devil, that these concepts of good and evil are culturally constructed and that they are specific to culture, to a specific cultures. That not everyone has the same idea or interpretation of what good and evil is. But in that world of 1500 before the Common Era, there is, in many respects, a sense of a world which is divided between two great forces fighting with each other, the forces of good and light, the forces of evil and darkness. And now, in a sense, time is no longer cyclical but lineal. It moves to an end. It moves to a conclusion, to the end of time and to the end of history. And thus we do not have these repeating cycles as the Stoics believe and other Judaism and Christianity, which are the children of this area, of this early way of thinking about time, are in a sense lineal religions, with a beginning, the moment of creation, with an end, the end of history, and the end of time. That, in many respects, is the millennium. The millennium has also other roots. The root, one of them, is the idea of paradise, which is common to many cultures, and which appears in what we call the Western tradition, and which is a misnomer, because it's not Western. It is an invented tradition. Essentially begins also with the Epic of Gilgamesh, the idea of a place where there is no pain, where there is no war, where there is plenty of food. And that enters as well the popular mind by the fabrication and ideas about places which are utopian in nature. The land of Kokenia, Schlaraffenland in German, Jauja in Spanish, a place where you do not have to work, where food comes flying into your mouth, hams and honey, the land of milk and honey. Have you ever been to Palestine? It's certainly a very desertic place. It's not a land of milk and honey. But we built it in the imagination, ideal places, paradises that we have lost. In many respects, this is the kind of longing of mankind for the world before agriculture, the world of hunting and gathering, a world that was limiting and harsh, but which was far better in terms of the ideas of work than the world that is grown out of that world, the world of agriculture and communities and social entities. And so that longing for a world in which people did not have to work, think of the idea of paradise. You don't work in paradise. You just collect things from the trees. Paradise is our prehistory. And when God thinks of how to punish Adam and Eve, she, he, it cannot come with anything better than work. And it is only in the 16th and 17th century that Puritans will make work sacred. But early people knew that work was, in fact, a form of punishment. And so the millennium is fed from all that, from that sense that time leads inexorably to an end, to a great conflagration, and so on. That there is this struggle between the forces of good and light, Ahura Mazda, and then the forces of evil and darkness, Angra Mihu, and therefore you have this conflict between the two of them. Within Christianity, there is an orthodox view of the millennium. We have essentially two orthodox views of the millennium. One is in Matthew 24, the Son of Man, the Messiah. This would be a time in which a holy people was to reign in Palestine in an era of peace and justice and plenty. There would be first an earthly king, then the Messiah, a superhuman figure within history and time. And then there is the other orthodox view. And you must realize that early Christianity is a religion of the end of time, and that the early Christians truly believe, for at least the first 150 years, that the end of time was at hand, which explains to a large extent why the early Christians lived the life they lead. That is to say, a world in which they have embraced the idea and the belief that it is within their own lifetimes that the world will come to an end, and that therefore you have to live accordingly to this idea that the world is in an end, that it will come to an end. Jesus have said it himself when he said, within your lifetimes the city will be obliterated. People will come and preach in my name. False prophets will appear. All of that, they will lead you into temptations, but do not give in, because the second coming is at hand. This is from the book of Apocalypse, or Revelation as it is called by others, by John 20. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding in his hand the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him into the pit, and locked and sealed it over him, so that he would deceive the nations no more, until the 1,000 years were ended. After that he must be let out for a little while. Then I saw thrones, and those seated on them were given authority to judge. I also saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for the testimony to Jesus and for the word of God. They had not worshipped the beast on his image and had not received its mark on their foreheads in their hands. Please remember this, because we're going to talk about the mark of the devil when we talk to about the wish craze. They came to life and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were ended. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy are those who share in the first resurrection. Over this, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ, and they will reign with him 1,000 years. When the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will come out to deceive the nations at the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, in order to gather them for battle. They are as numerous as the sands of the sea. They march up over the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and their beloved city. And fire came down from heaven and consumed them. And the devil who had deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beasts and the false prophets were. And they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. So in a sense, you have here the classical formulation of the millennium. There is a struggle, the devil is seized, and chain in hell for 1,000 years. 1,000 years of prosperity and peace and conquering. Some of the good Christians who have testified for Christ will be resurrected and will reign the millennium, the 1,000 years. And then, of course, the final battle will come. So in that orthodox Christian view, the millennium is within time, within history. And then the great battle will come, where the devil and his followers will be cast into hell forevermore. And then history will end, and time will end. you could see how powerful this could be, how extraordinarily appealing this will be, so that, in a sense, for the next 2,000 years until this very day, people will look for the signs that tell them that the end is at hand. People will knock at your door and tell you that you have to be saved because the end is at hand. Now, there are other formulations. One of them is, of course, the Sabbath age, which is borrowed from Judaism. That is to say that God rested on the seventh day, and so will mankind. The seventh age falls within history. It acquires a Christian phase through the works of Lactantius, a great Christian poet of the fourth century. That is to say, a rising crescendo of evil and disturbances, plagues, wars, evil kings, false prophets, they will all be the signs of the coming. Then the righteous are besieged in the mountain by the Antichrist. It's the beginnings of the idea of the Antichrist. They call God his sense of liberator, usually an emperor. And then he does final battle, and then Christ comes back and does final battle with the Antichrist. The resurrection of the dead, the last judgment follows, and history comes to an end. There is a third way of looking at this, and this is the work of a Calabrian monk in the late 12th and early 13th century named Joachim of Fiori, who lived between 1135 and 1202. He was the abbot of a Cistercian monastery in Calabria. He asked permission from the Pope to write his visions. He wrote a book which was an exposition on the book of Apocalypse, on Revelations. And he thinks, by drawing parallels between the Old and the New Testament, that he can, in fact, predict that now we have three ages of mankind. One age presided by God the Father, which goes from the beginnings of history to the birth of Jesus. Another age which goes from the birth of Jesus to, we still live in it, Joachim will say, which is the age of the Son. And then the third age, the age of the Holy Spirit. And in the age of the Holy Spirit, humans will not need the intermediary powers of priests and of the church. They will have direct access to God. This is important. Joachimite ideas will become very important in the West, and people will think in the Middle Ages that 1260 was the beginning of the third age, and that Francis of Assisi was in fact the sign, the watershed that marks the beginning of a new age. So flagellants, whom we are going to see next section, and Francis Fraticelli will follow the ideas of Joachim and will predict the coming of the new millennium. And then, of course, we have the idea of a king who is asleep and will return. This is the king who lies in waiting to lead the host of the Christians against the Antichrist. In the early 13th century, there is such a king. It's Frederick II of Hohenstaufen, the ruler of Sicily, the Holy Roman Emperor. He actually builds a propaganda around himself that he is, in some respects, a kind of new Messiah. And to this very day, people wait for either Frederick Barbarossa or Frederick II, two very different Fredericks, to awaken from their slumber, from their sleep. They are sleeping caves, and to lead people into the new millennium. And so you could see how this plays a role in the history of the West. May I point out to you that people in Europe did not know when the year 1000 was. But from the year 1000 onwards, we have manifestations of a great deal of millenarian movements. The First Crusade, the conquest of Jerusalem in 1095, they are all going to trigger a great deal of millenarian movements throughout Europe, disturbances, all of which have also a social context, a social background. It is the poor, it is the downtrodden, it is the oppressed who see this as a moment of liberation in which they can, in a sense, escape the terror of their lives, embrace this idea of 1,000 years of peace and plenty. All these stories are detailed in the great book by Norman Cohn called The Pursuit of the Millennium. And Norman Cohn argues, and I think quite convincingly, that there is a important relationship between millenarian movements and totalitarian movements of the modern age, because in many respects, many totalitarian movements use the millennium as a kind of idea to, in a sense, co-opt people into the movement. So Hitler could speak, making a historical reference to a Third Reich that will last 1,000 years, that the image of the millennium is still with us. Thank you.